Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey friends, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. You can always visit me online. I'm at reconnectwithcarmen.com. And if you want to get ministry updates, you can actually just text the word reconnect to 22828. One of my ministry partners just actually informed me that that's actually a cool way for people to connect with us, and I didn't know. So if you just want to connect with the ministry, you can do so by texting the word reconnect to 22828. Okay, so the Roman Catholic institutional church is in a crisis. If you have been paying attention even at a cursory level to the unfolding events in Roman Catholicism, then you know that not only are we dealing with seemingly wave after wave of allegations of clergy sexual abuse. You will recall that a couple of weeks ago we talked here on the Reconnect about the really extraordinary report that came out of a grand jury in Pennsylvania related to the sexual abuse of more than 1,000 identified victims and more than 300 priest perpetrators. And so that has unfolded over the course of the last couple of weeks into what some people are openly calling a civil war in the Roman Catholic Church. You can, when you see that language, when you see language of such internal disagreement and strife that it rises to the level of war and then civil war, if you are a Protestant Christian, you can't help but wonder, are we on the verge of a new Reformation? And so that's actually the conversation that I would like to provoke among Protestants, because as Protestants, and if you are a Roman Catholic Christian, let me just say to you that no one is celebrating what is happening in Roman Catholicism. Everyone is grieving. There is nothing about anything in this story of clergy sexual abuse, nor the cover-ups related to it, nor the denial of the institution about it, nor the contributions that Roman Catholics have given in offering plates that have then been of necessity paid out to victims. To the tune of we know the number is more than $4 billion since 1950. So I would direct you, if you want to read about this, I would actually direct you to Mark Thiessen's op-ed in the New York Times. I think he does a really excellent job distilling not only the facts of where we're at in the conversation, but of basically coming down to this point, something has to change. Something has to change. And so if you've reached the point in an institution like the Roman Catholic Church that something has to change, you are going to have those who resist change of any kind, who resist information coming to light, who resist transparency, because sin likes darkness. And sin likes to be left alone and likes to distract and redirect and get us thinking about other things and moving on, nothing to see here. Well, 501 years ago, there was a priest named Martin Luther who wanted to point out to his superiors inside the Roman Catholic Church that that not only were the lay people being victimized by the clergy, then through something called indulgences, not through clergy sexual abuse, as is the case today, but abused nonetheless. The lay people of Luther's day were being victimized by the priests of the day, and Luther wanted the hierarchy to do something about it. He wanted to see internal reform in Roman Catholicism according to the Word of God. And so If we were able to turn back the clock 501 years, and we were able to provide Martin Luther with the kind of instant global lay and clergy interactive reporting that is available today, I'm talking here obviously not only about journalism and its global nature, But I'm talking about social media and the ability of people to know everything instantaneously about everyone. And even though sometimes it takes some time for the facts to come out and be known, it doesn't take anything near the time that it took in Luther's day. We're not talking about, you know, nailing a letter to a door in one particular village. We're talking about, in the case of Nuncio Vigano, we're talking about the distribution of an 11-page letter that not only confirms the knowledge of the Vatican and the Pope of what was going on, not only here in the United States of America, but in other jurisdictions around the world related to clergy sexual abuse, but the systemic covering up and even the systemic elevation within Roman Catholicism of perpetrator priests. And so Mark Thiessen says it has to change. Something has to change. And here are the two options he says that Roman Catholicism actually has in front of it today. He says the Roman Catholic Church either is going to have to double down on its requirement for chastity. And here he is addressing in particular the issue of homosexual practice among priests. But chastity, or the church has to publicly abandon those standards and allow priests to openly engage in homosexual relationships. Now, I would contend that that would also mean allowing heterosexual priests to marry. Now, one imagines that the same liberty would have to be extended, right, to other religious orders. So now we would be talking not only about priests getting married and priests who are gay getting married to same-sex partners, but also nuns having the liberty to be married. I got to tell you, that would be a pretty radical change in Roman Catholicism. I'm not suggesting that that is the path forward that the Roman Catholic Church should take. You know, I would say that holiness and chastity are the call, and holiness and chastity ought to be the standard, and Roman Catholicism needs to then figure out how that standard is actually going to be lived out in its communion. I do think that one of the things that will continue to happen will be mass departures. You can look at the nation of Ireland for an indicator or an exemplar of what is likely to happen in Roman Catholicism here in the United States. People are going to leave. People are certainly going to stop contributing. And they're going to stop expecting the Roman Catholic Church to provide them reliable guidance in relationship to sexuality and sexual matters, when in fact, internally, those are not promises that are being kept by priests who made them. There are also huge financial and legal repercussions to all of this. Research by the National Catholic Register, published in 2015, found that between 1950 and August of 2015, the Roman Catholic Church had paid out just shy of $4 billion in clergy sex-related settlements. It also estimated that contributions due to the loss of membership or members withholding their giving related to the scandals was costing the church actively, year over year over year, $2.3 billion annually. So how might things be different today than they were 501 years ago? I think we can hope that the Roman Catholic Church today would see the calls of clergy and of lay men and women within Catholicism, would see their calls for internal reform, massive internal reform, costly internal reform, serious internal reform, according to the Word of God, that the systems, that the hierarchy, that the Roman Catholic Church would actually this time choose to suffer reformation within versus wholesale schism, which in my view is the other option. Now, I do think that today, if there were to be a wholesale schism in Roman Catholicism, one of the ways that it would differ from that which took place in the Protestant Reformation now 500 years ago is that because this is all happening everywhere all at once, this is a global event, so too I think this schism would be what I know this is going to sound strange, but it'll be a unified schism. It would be the schism of one Roman Catholic Church into theoretically two parts instead of a geographically splintered under several reformers version, which was the outcome of the Protestant Reformation, in large part because, you know, you really couldn't have a global leader of anything in the days of Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and, you know, and others. Right. Each one of those guys could only talk to the people that were in the room at the time and could only and their messages could only be communicated as fast as scribes could write. So now we have the democratization of information and we have it in the context of a generation where there is the rejection of authority and the elevated value of autonomy. We certainly have the loss of faith in institutions, and we have a very real and apparently very rampant sin. And so how is that going to resolve itself? Well, first of all, I think that we need to recognize that what we are witnessing is potentially as significant as the events in Wittenberg 500 years ago. And then to answer the question that I think we should each be asking ourselves, how am I supposed to respond and how am I supposed to engage? Number one, I think that we need to recognize our Catholic neighbors are hurting. And they're doubting and they're wondering. And as I have already said to you here on Connecting Faith in relationship to this story, we now have to turn to our Roman Catholic friends, and we actually have to, in absolute merciful humility, ask them, did anything like that ever happen to you? Because sin hides in darkness and is often covered up in years and decades of silence. And so if you don't get a very straightforward answer of no, then you have to keep pressing. You have to keep asking. You have to keep assuring your friend, your neighbor, your husband, your wife, your grandmother, that you will listen without any condemnation, and that anything that happened to them at the hands of a priest was not their fault. Was not their fault. Some of our Roman Catholic neighbors now understand the actions of Martin Luther and the reformers in a whole new way. And that actually provides for us an opportunity for some reconciliation with our Roman Catholic neighbors and friends. Now, granted, there are certainly still some who are in denial, and they are growing ever more defensive. This is a fear-based response. And I don't think that we can dismiss it. You have to recognize that for many Roman Catholics, their world is literally now crashing down around them. The Protestant Reformation didn't just happen in the church. It happened culture-wide. And so, too, if this is going to genuinely be that kind of reformation, it will be culture-wide as well. All right. Let's lighten things up a bit. The New York Times ran an article yesterday about the Minnesota State Fair. And so I thought last night we should send our producer, Rachel Sutton, to the fair. She'd never been. She went. And so next up, Rachel is joining me to talk about getting God back into the conversation over corn dogs and carnival rides and blue ribbon 4-H animals. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be right back. Okay, that is our State Fair-themed music today. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I am joined by producer Rachel Sutton. She went as a newbie to the Minnesota State Fair last night. Rachel, welcome to your own program, Connecting Faith.
Hey, thanks, Carmen. It's great to be here.
So I read an article yesterday in the New York Times. Part of the article said the Minnesota State Fair is the biggest state fair in the United States by daily attendance. And this year it broke the record for the most visitors to ever attend on opening day. You went. Give us some facts.
Yeah, man, it's crazy. There's so many people. So just a few facts from the Minnesota State Fair website here. The fairgrounds make up 322 acres. Sweet Martha's Cookie Jar produces 3 million cookies every day. That's
what?
Crazy. 3 million. The corn roast booth serves 25,000 ears of corn every day. And over 100,000 people attend the fair on an average day, with the peak days, Saturday and Sunday, typically looking more like 200,000. So just to put that in perspective for you, a city in Minnesota that is that population is Rochester, Minnesota. in Wisconsin, you've got Green Bay, Wisconsin. And if you're listening in Fargo or Hartford, that's your city every day.
The entire city, let's just imagine everybody in Hartford, Connecticut went to the fair on one day. That's how many people are at the Minnesota State Fair on a given day. That's what you're telling us.
Yes.
Okay, that's a lot of people. I wonder if our listeners in Hartford have ever experienced their city as a citywide fair on any given day, because that's a pretty fun way to think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a ton of people.
Okay, so what were your general impressions of the Minnesota State Fair?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we walked in, I was with my husband, and I think my exact words were, wow, and then take a few steps, wow. And so just so much food, just stands and stands of food and tons of people. Just the streets are packed and there's not an open square foot there. So we went and we got hot dogs, cheese curds, ice cream, fried cookie dough. If you've never had fried cookie dough, that is a thing to try.
Okay. So this New York Times reporter talked about like dairy pageants and sculpting of butter and a lumberjack show and Christmas trees and a rainbow-colored giant slide. Did you see any of these things?
I saw the slide and I saw the butter sculptures. And, you know, I think when you go for 3 or 4 hours to the fair, it's a different experience than when you go all day. And I think that's probably the way to do it, is to take a day, just go and really be able to see everything. We did see the butter sculptures, though. Like I said, that's just crazy, people's faces and...
So I'm thinking to myself right now that we have listeners in Iowa who are thinking to themselves that their butter sculptures, or people in Wisconsin, right? Those two places, I feel confident they also have butter sculptures. And I don't know. See, now we might be lifting up among our listeners a little bit of a competitive spirit in terms of fair finds. So, hey, friends, let me just remind you, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We thought we'd lighten it up a little bit today and talk here for a moment about something that at least all of our listeners across the state of Minnesota and those within driving distance of Minnesota are certainly actively engaged in. I know that growing up, I grew up in Florida, and the state fair was fun, but I would say that our county fair actually, in my memory, you know, stands out more significantly. So when we talk about a state fair, are there things like 4-H and all of that at a state fair, or is that just a county fair thing?
You know, I did not actually go to those areas of the fair. I believe there are, though, and there's animals. I believe there's petting zoos and dogs you can watch. I've heard about the great dog shows, so... Certainly there's areas, if you're an animal lover, you can definitely check that out.
Okay, and how about this 360-degree sky flyer swing ride?
Yeah, we were seeing some of these crazy rides just going around and around and people screaming, you know, as usual. What do you expect there?
All right, so I totally love it. Now, here on Connecting Faith, one of the things we're trying to do is reconnect the eternal with the everyday. So as far as connecting the eternal to the everyday, you have any observations to make about the fair?
Yeah, you know, so Carmen, you gave me this assignment yesterday to think about that as I was going, and I was pondering it, and I was, you know, there's sometimes where you're thinking, how can we put God into these scenarios, you know, and obviously he's there all the time, he's with us, but sometimes it can seem like, yeah, how do you make that work? But I think some observations, some things I came away with are, God gave us enjoyment. He made food taste good. You know, that's something he didn't have to do. He could have nourished us in any other way. And so I think that's one aspect of the state fair that we can enjoy. And obviously, at the state fair, that can turn into gluttony pretty fast. But I think we need to be thankful that God delights in our enjoyment and takes joy in our joy. And along with that, at the fair, something I was just recently writing was my personal statement of faith for a college assignment that I was doing. And we were supposed to kind of connect these sentences that we were writing with how that impacts our everyday lives and the people that we interact with. And one statement that I made was, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and that he lived a sinless life, died paying the penalty for our sins, and rose victorious over death. And that's kind of something we would talk about in church. That's something we would say in church. But I think this changes our outlook and our attitude about everything, that we can go and approach things with joy and fearlessness. And so I just would encourage people, when you're going to this unique opportunity to be with 100,000 people who are there to enjoy life and enjoy this community together, even though it's a huge community of Minnesota, we have the opportunity to give glory to God in these places and to come in with an attitude that the people around us do notice when we're just interacting with people and starting conversations.
So here are a few of my, excuse me, not from my experience at the Minnesota State Fair, where I've never been, but my observations that are sort of fair related on the same topic. I think the observations that you make about food, any opportunity that we can help people taste and see that the Lord is good. And so I don't really know exactly how I would use fair food to do that, but I would be willing to, you know, spend some time at the fair and cultivate my ability to make those theological connections. That might be kind of selfish. But there's so much color there as well. And there's a genuinely diverse crowd. One of the things that I love about the fair is that it puts me in proximity with people who I would otherwise literally never have occasion to interact with. I don't know where they live. I don't know what they do. I don't know how they're spending their free time on other days. But when we're in that fair environment together, you are kind of one people. You become kind of a one people group. Everybody's kind of after the same thing, which is to simply enjoy that time and that particular place. So I do think that there are ways in which, we can say, hey, even though it is a real, almost obscene overabundance of food that's generally not very healthy, we can say the abundance of what happens at the fair and the joy and the colors and the lights and the opportunity to interact with an extremely diverse crowd of people. Maybe that does give us a little glimpse of what the kingdom of heaven might be like. Not that I think there are going to be carnival rides, which I don't like, but maybe there are going to be opportunities to genuinely interact with a really broad diversity of people. All right. I gave you an assignment to talk to some strangers. What did you hear that was interesting?
Yeah, for sure. Really, people are so willing to have conversation. That's really fun. I think we get so scared to approach people and just talk to strangers, but they were super willing and really interesting to hear their perspectives, where they come from, how many times they've been to the fair, whether that's overall or just this year. And one question that I asked was, how do we approach meaningful conversations and moments at the fair? And people really said through kindness in the lines, just showing the generosity of kindness that is really rare in our world. But you really talked about that when you're saying that there's this diverse group of people at the fair and we have the opportunity to be with each other and show that kindness. So great experience, and I would recommend it.
Well, Rachel, thank you for going out on our behalf and sharing your observations today. Friends, there are opportunities around us all the time to bear witness to the goodness of who God is and the abundance of his grace and the kindness of Christianity. All right, we frequently talk here on Connecting Faith about how to speak the truth in ways that honor Jesus. Next up, I'm going to have a conversation with Jack Alexander about his new book, The God Impulse, The Power of Mercy in an Unmerciful World. I'm Carmen Lever. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined by Jack Alexander. He is the chairman of the Reimagine Group, a senior fellow at the Sagamore Institute, author of The God Guarantee. And the book that we're here to talk about today is The God Impulse, The Power of Mercy in an Unmerciful World. Jack, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey, Carmen, great to be with you.
So we like to reconnect the eternal with the everyday, and it sounds like today you're reconnecting with nature. My producer tells me that you are calling from a kayak on a river in North Georgia.
That's correct. That's okay, beautiful. So, and
you're living the life, man. You are living the life.
Well, we're celebrating my wife's birthday, and we wanted to do this, but we didn't want to miss the radio program.
Oh, well, you're so kind. Well, please give us, please give her, Lisa, right? Please give Lisa our,
yeah,
our happy birthday wishes.
Happy birthday, Lise. Just told her for you.
Thank you. Okay, so I saw on Twitter that you recently sat down with our friend, David Kenneman. What are you doing with Barna Research?
Yeah, well, in writing this book, there were some instincts I had. For example, something I call in the book called the outsourcing of compassion. And so what Barna did was did a national study. And so, for example, they found that 83% of Christians basically feel like showing mercy isn't their personal responsibility. So they outsource it and to churches and Christian organizations and to the government. And so that's sort of the issue here, is that we're so busy, we don't take time to be kind. In the book, I mentioned that Microsoft says that we have 8-second attention spans now. So we're just very busy people, and when we do show compassion, often we outsource it to organizations.
Okay, so that's kind of disturbing on the surface of it. I mean, one of the observations that you make is that if any of us were just to begin scrolling through, let's say, our news feed or certainly our social media feeds, you know, the sad news is out there, and it's deep sadness throughout the population. And so all kinds of stories related to despair or disillusionment or suicide, the breakup of marriages, I mean, just on and on and on. And into each and every one of those situations and scenarios, we as Christians are called to go as Christ would go, as a person of mercy. That's what it feels like you are seeking to equip and empower people to do in this book.
Yeah, I think so. I think Jesus in Matthew 9, it says that he basically went out and preached and he healed. So, and then he sent his followers to preach and to heal. So that's basically, when we represent both truth and mercy, we're representing the character of God. And Barna basically says the church as a whole is under-indexing mercy. So conservatives, a lot of us have a high view of truth that's appropriate. But because we're so busy, we're not doing regular acts of mercy. And one of the things I point out in the book is all the rewards, Carmen, of a merciful life. I think most of my years as a Christian, I thought, well, we need to do good deeds. We need to be kind to the poor. But it's really an investment in the kingdom, and I've just seen it pay off in my life and in other people's lives.
So when you use give us an example. Give us just it could take a second to do something merciful in the life of another person. So when you're talking about acts of mercy, give us some examples.
Yeah, just as a small thing, my wife and I have had people live in our house for 15 years. We've had three young women in a row who've gotten engaged where they've lived with us, and they would come up and have meals with us and ask us questions. We've never charged anybody anything to live with us. We had one woman who was with us 3 years, and 1,000 women turned around from having abortions while she lived with us. She counseled women. So it can be somebody living with you. There's a couple people who are really struggling without jobs that we meet with regularly. I mentor 4 kids who've lost their fathers in very difficult circumstances. So it can be big things or small things, but our lives get richer when they're woven together with other people. But it seems like it's messy. It seems like it's costly. And people basically just say, I don't have time for this.
So, friends, we're talking with Jack Alexander. He is, among other things, the author of The God Impulse, The Power of Mercy in an Unmerciful World. We've got a couple of copies to give away. So if you if this interests you and you would like to have the mercy side of your faith energized, bringing truth and mercy not only into conversation, but in active cooperation in your life of faith as it's lived out day to day, either give us a call or text us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Or you can always email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. So, Jack, I think that I'm aware of people who have the mercy impulse or the mercy instinct or whatever language you might apply to this. I'm also very aware of people who don't live like this. And those are people who, frankly, I don't want to be around. And so can you talk about the mercy part of this as... In our culture, it's often divorced from truth. Like, you know, I've got these people who they want to be truth tellers, but they're so unmerciful. There's nothing attractive or winsome or beautiful about the gospel that they're proclaiming. Can you talk about the importance of mercy and truth being held together in their inseparable nature?
Well, see, truth brings hope. I mean, Jesus is our hope. The gospel's our hope. But mercy brings healing. And just imagine, Jesus never outsourced anything, Carmen. He went to the leper and touched his skin. He went to the blind man, put mud on his eyes. He goes out of his way to go into Samaria to teach a woman about living water and washed his disciples' feet when he knew that they were going to abandon him. And biggest of all, of course, he went to the cross. And so our model continually showed mercy, and he showed mercy to sinners. He said he was a friend of sinners. Another concerning thing about the Barna research is that Christians, by a factor of 10 to 1, want to be merciful to victims. So if you got hit by a hurricane or you're poor, I mean, God's heart is close to the brokenhearted, but it showed that we don't want to be merciful to prisoners, to people who've sinned against us, to our enemies, by a factor of 10 to 1. And so I think that's where we can differentiate ourselves by going to people who've hurt us and just reaching out to them and loving them and praying for them.
So don't you think a huge part of that, Jack, is our ability to empathize? I mean, to recognize that, I mean, had just about anything in my life been different, my situation could absolutely be the situation that person now finds themselves in.
Yeah, and it just takes humility to see that. And the heart of the gospel is we're all lawbreakers. I've done things before where I sped. I did different things where I could have gotten locked up. And just having that sense of compassion that this could have been me, and that's where Jesus went. He went to the prostitutes. He went to the people who had alcohol issues. He went to those people and was criticized by the religious people. So it hurts my heart to see so many in the church just preferring to either outsource mercy or sort of redefine who deserves it, because none of us do.
I resonate with that. I probably need to evaluate in my own life, like where are the times and places where, you know, I need to forego whatever it is that I imagine I need to spend this time doing, and instead actually spend it intentionally showing mercy to someone that I could simply help by my willingness to be present.
Yeah, I have a very emotional story. My wife and I, there was an epidemic of suicides in India, and 3,000 widows, we've helped protect them and care for them and their kids for the last 10 years. And Lisa and I had a grandson named Sam, and he was born with a spectrum disorder. And I tell you, this guy in India, he got cards out with Sam's picture to all these widows in India who prayed for him every day. And Sam still has some real issues, but they told us a couple weeks ago he's in the 75th percentile for comprehension. And the doctors just literally said, we don't even know how that happened. Mm-hmm. And so I think when Jesus said, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy, it just comes alive when you see stories of people who, we call it in the book, build bridges for others. Then all of a sudden their kid gets in trouble or they get in trouble, and God builds a bridge for them and protects them. So these daily mercies that we are so dependent on from the Lord, the broken and lost world is dependent on us to give them daily mercies.
Friends, if you would like a copy of The God Impulse, The Power of Mercy in an Unmerciful World by Jack Alexander, we've got some copies. And so you can enter the drawing for those at 877-933-2484. You can either call or text that number. Again, it's 877-933-2484. Jack, why don't we share with folks, give us an example of mercy from the Bible, something that just really touches your heart.
Well, it touches me, the publican who he was crying out, the Pharisees were taking their offerings and throwing them in the offering plate so loud everybody could hear it. And the publican cries out and he says, have mercy on me, God, a sinner. And Jesus looked at his disciples and he said, that's the one who is justified. You know, he's crying for mercy. And I think that God hears our cries. And you know, I love it. I think two times in the Psalms, David says, I'm poor and needy. You know, here he's king of Israel. I think so when we see ourselves as poor and needy and we cry out to the Lord for mercy, he so desires, I guess if there's one thing I'd want the listeners to understand is, he so desires, the God impulse, that's why I named the book that, is to show mercy to you. And we can become over-indexed on a truth side of things that can make us arrogant. It can make us like the Pharisees. And we need the humility both to come before God and to others and to serve them with mercy.
So you conclude the book with a chapter entitled Gasp. Tell us what at this stage makes you gasp, and what is it about whatever we do that enables another person to really gasp?
Well, I told the story from Les Mis, you know, when the bishop, you know, could have arrested, had Jean Valjean arrested, and he says, oh, he forgot the candlesticks. And the whole crowd, if you've seen that movie or that play, gasps when they see that, because it's giving mercy to somebody when they need justice. I had a guy who worked for me, and he stole on his expense report. And I called him in and listened to him. And, you know, he ended up running one of our divisions a year or so later. And I saw the best in him. We have mercy when we see the best in someone else. Call them to it. And it's so easy. There's an old saying, we want mercy for ourselves and justice for everybody else. And I think if we're going to love our neighbors as ourselves, I think it makes people gasp when you show mercy to them when you could take a hardline approach.
Well, and you couple that in the book with the whole concept of tenderness. And I think that when we think about the mercy of God, we certainly think about his tender mercies. Justice never seems tender. Right. I mean, it just, you know,
but
it's sort of inherent.
Truth, you know, I really want the listeners to understand, too, that if somebody's an addict, if somebody's abusive, that we have a saying in the book, always show mercy unless showing being merciful isn't merciful. And so there's times when tough love is needed. There's times when lines and boundaries do need to be drawn. And so I'm not like way over on this edge of mercy. I think what we're trying to do is, to the extent the church has gotten imbalanced. I mean, if you look at like Grudem's Systematic Theology book, it's a 1,207-page book. It has one paragraph in the whole book on mercy. So what we're trying to do is bring mercy and truth back into balance. And Psalm 85:10 says, when mercy and truth meet, righteousness and peace kiss. And that's the world we all want to live in. We want righteousness and peace, and that's the way it happens.
Amen. Let's leave it right there with righteousness and peace kissing. And you can return to the joyful celebration of Lisa's birthday on that river in northeast
right.
Georgia. Enjoy the day. Thank you so much for the gift of the book, The God Impulse, The Power of Mercy in an Unmerciful World. Jack Alexander, appreciate your time today.
It's been a pleasure. God bless you, Carmen. Take care.
Thank you. You too. All right, bye-bye. Friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back to make the connecting point.
Surely something slipped your mind.
You forgot.
I gave these also. Would you leave the best behind?
Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We are we're going to make the connecting point, and we're going to settle in here on the concept of mercy for just a moment. We certainly want to be speaking the truth, and we want to be speaking the truth in a culture that rejects the idea of truth and often rejects the one who is the way and the truth and the life. And so when we are speaking the truth in the world today, I think we are often tempted to do so in ways that are sort of demanding that people would listen to the truth and come to terms with it. And one of the things that Jack Alexander just highlighted for us, and my friend Scott Sauls at Christ Presbyterian Church in Nashville often points out, is that nobody that I've ever known in my whole life has, you know, come to the place of faith in Jesus Christ and an embrace of the gospel because somebody browbeat them. It's just not how it happens. No one's ever argued to the point of faith. People become convinced by the combination of truth and grace. Jesus came full of truth and grace. Jack Alexander puts that together as mercy. And I think that we can have those kinds of conversations where we are both representing, or maybe that's not even the right way to say it, where we are representing the fullness of the gospel in all of its beauty, grace and truth. And so how can you and I be substantial, beautiful witnesses of who Christ is? Well, in order to do that, we actually have to represent the gospel in gospel ways. We have to speak the truth in ways that honor Jesus. We can never create a division where there isn't one between the reality of the fullness of Christ and who he is. And that's not just confined to the story of his incarnation, from the point of his incarnation to the point of his ascension. No, it's all of history. Jesus is the second member of the Trinity forever. He is present in creation, and he is, even as the ascended Christ, we know in advance he's also going to be the one who reigns in the kingdom of heaven, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I mean, so there's some positive, winsome things that we ought to be talking about and filling our conversations with as we approach people in the world. But I think that one of the things that my conversation with Jack highlights and reminds us of is that there are a lot of really vulnerable people who are right on the edge, right on the edge. Maybe you know an individual or a family that is right on the edge. A quick scan of my news feed, over the course of a 24-hour period of time, these four headlines popped out at me. In Montana, the story is that is now the state with the highest rate of suicide in the country. There was the story of the suicide of a 9-year-old boy. A 13-year-old boy here in my own community took his own life. A very young husband, a father and pastor of a California megachurch, took his own life. I had to stop and pray. I had to stop and just spend some time before the Lord asking what is going on in our culture? What is not happening that needs to be happening? How is it that so many people are, first of all, living so close to the edge? And then why? Why are so many in what seems to be ever-increasing numbers with ever-increasing frequency taking their own lives? Why is there so much despair? And why are people choosing death over life? And so when Jack mentioned he mentioned his grandson, whose name is Sam, I immediately thought of another Sam, because Sam was the name of the 13-year-old boy in my community who took his own life a week ago. And so here we have been weeping and lamenting and grieving with those who grieve. We have found time that we didn't know we had to stop and spend with each other. We have found time we didn't know we had in our schedules to have conversations with our kids and in classrooms and in sanctuaries and across the community to just stop and talk with each other, walking in the park, or stop and talk with each other, at the mailbox in the road. There are times to laugh and there are times to weep. I mean, we know from the book of Ecclesiastes, there are times for everything, seasons during which we have to just stop and weep. Scott Sauls is this family's pastor. And so I'm going to draw here on some of Scott's comments related to Sam's death. He said to the congregation on Sunday, "We need to remember that we have only said a temporary goodbye to Sam." And I think that that's important. I think that the way that Scott framed it in terms of, you know, we've said a temporary goodbye to Sam, who battled depression and in a moment of vulnerability and isolation took his own life. That's a very sensitive and accurate way to describe what happened. And so I think that one of the things that we have to do is prepare ourselves for these kinds of conversations. And so Scott tells his congregation on Sunday, you know, we're going to pause today because that's actually one of the things that experts tell us to do. They tell us that we actually have to stop and talk about it. And when these kinds of things take place, the best prevention from it happening again is to talk about it. To not talk about it is actually contributes to these repetitive kinds of activities and tragedies. So you say to yourself, you know, I hear that this is on the rise nationally. How bad is it? Suicide is now the leading cause of death in America for people 10 to 24 years of age. Let me repeat that. Suicide is now the leading cause of death in the United States of America for people 10 to 24 years of age. However old your kids or grandkids are, it is not too early to have a conversation with them about how they're feeling, about their hopes and dreams, about your love for them, about the future filled with hope that God has for them, and about the fact that you are always available anytime, anywhere, at any hour of the day or night to hear them out, whatever it is, however deep the pain and grief. Because isolation is the friend or the weapon that the enemy utilizes in the midst of despair to push someone to the breaking point. Why is this happening? Well, the primary answer is a theological one. You go all the way back to the Garden of Eden, and chaos began pressing in upon us with the introduction of sin into what was paradise. Romans 8 describes it as creation now groaning with eager longing for man's redemption. And so when we see people in travail, when we see them on the very edge, wondering if death might be preferable to life, we have to remember that that life is not what it was intended to be. Revelation 21 actually accurately describes the world filled with death, mourning, crying, and pain. That's actually where we live now. So to despair of life in this world is actually normal. And so it's abnormal to have a peace which passes all understanding and a joy regardless of the circumstances. And the only way that we have those attributes and live in that reality is to know Christ. And so there is a theological conversation that must take place if we want to find our way, not only as individuals and families and congregations, but as a society, out of the growing darkness and prevalence of suicide and into the light of shared life. Let me offer you the Psalms as a good place to turn for statements about a world that's gone wrong, well, where there's honest lament and sorrow in community. And then let's also remember that we have great hope that endures forever and an anchor that holds within the storm. And to know Christ is to know both the peace which passes all understanding and the contentment and the joy, no matter the circumstances of life in which we might find ourselves. There is a future filled with hope that God has planned, and we are the agents of his mercy and truth in the context of this generation. So let's live into that calling today. All right, friends, you have been listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. You can visit us online at myfaithradio.com. Connecting Faith has a page there. I also have a ministry website at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.